Support for PrayPublic is provided by the Bush Foundation, investing in great ideas and the people who power them. Introducing the recipients of the 2024 Bush Fellowship. Learn more about the 2024 Fellows at bushfoundation.org/fellows.
Welcome to this Wednesday edition of Main Street. I'm your host, Craig Blumenschein. Coming up in the second half of today's show, Tom Ezern, our great friend, stops by with another Plainspoke essay. This one's titled Grass Widows. It gives definition to a phrase Tom has heard in the past. Rick Dion also stops by with another edition of Prairie Plates, talking about the needed food nonprofits in the area. We'll re-air an excerpt from the Great American Folk Show on the Theodore Roosevelt Presidential Library and an interview with Edward O'Keefe. But we open today with an interview my former colleague Ashley Thornburg had with John Ford Dunker. You can see him on shows like Blue Bloods on CBS. He's Detective Keith Harper.
John, thanks so much for joining us today.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Congratulations on doing the thing.
Thank you.
So when did you decide that you wanted to move out to New York? A lot of people think about moving to East Coast or West Coast and pursuing dreams of acting or being a musician. Not as many people do it, and then fewer still actually end up getting cast in anything.
Yeah, I mean, I think the decision to move out here came in college. I went to school for musical theater at the University of Wisconsin in Stevens Point, and it was sort of just I don't even remember making a decision. It was just kind of expected that if you were going to pursue that field, that you would go to New York, because that's sort of where, especially for musical theater, that's kind of the mecca for it. I've pretty much done, with one exception, like no musical theater. So that's what brought me out here, and then ended up doing a bunch of other stuff. But yeah, that's where that came from.
What is it about musical theater you love so much?
You know, honestly, I did it a lot in high school and college, and then I auditioned for University of Wisconsin for both their acting and musical theater program, and I got into both, and they were like, can you, you know, tell us which one you would prefer, you know, that'll help us kind of figure out where you fit in here. And I just said, honestly, I said musical theater to be more well-rounded. I mean, I love to sing. Me and my brothers, we get our singing chops from my mom. She's a great singer. And, so that's where that came from. And I love doing it, but it's interesting. It's just never panned out. And I think I do still like it, but I think maybe I'm not as passionate about musical theater specifically as I used to be. It's kind of shifted to more like TV and film and movies. But again, it was like interesting looking back, like that decision got me out here.
Yeah. So. Well, it is a little bit of an actor-like quality to be very into the thing that they're doing. The fact that you can feel like a cop to play a cop, or feel, like someone in Fiddler on the Roof when you're cast in something like that. But talk a little bit more about this idea, John, of expectation versus reality, and not just the, okay, I wanted to, you know, land in the first biggest movie of the year on one tryout, because that's never how it works. but even just this idea that maybe you were going to be pursuing musical theater, but then you ended up in much more serious roles on TV, often playing kind of a cop and a bad guy. Talk about how you sort of navigate that mental headspace of what you thought you were going for and what you ended up with.
Yeah, so I mean, I think it helped a little bit that as I was kind of going through college and coming out here, that was kind of right as social media was taking off. So I think this idea that everything happens quickly comes from largely from social media. And so I think I kind of I wasn't working against that, which was good. But, you know, social media kind of perpetuates this overnight success thing where like, oh, you just land in a certain market or a video goes viral or this or that. And then, you know, you're off to the races. Whereas for me, It was very much the opposite of that. Even with, so with musical theater, you know, the expectation is that, you know, you're getting up at 5 a.m., you're auditioning for things that are, you know, performing around the country or Broadway or what have you. And, you know, I went to all those auditions, and some of them, the ones that panned out ended up being more for like new plays and like more classical work and plays really, not even really TV and film. And didn't really, basically I had been here for 5 or 6 years before I even did anything with TV and film. And, you know, that first thing is just like, you know, one line. And then like the next thing is next project, I had like two lines. And then it's just sort of, for me, you know, and it's different for everybody. Other people's experience might be different, but the expectation is that it just kind of happens overnight. But, you know, you hear people say this a lot. It's like the overnight successes are typically like 20 years in the making. It's just like, that's not the part that anyone wants to focus on.
Right. On social media, we tend to compare somebody else's highlight reel to our, you know, behind the scenes footage.
Very much so.
You know, I am old enough that when I was first going to school for photojournalism, we were still shooting on film. It was right as the school was transitioning over to digital. And I remember one of my photography professors saying that getting one usable shot out of a roll of 36 was considered great. How many auditions do you have to go to get these one and two liner things? Like you personally?
Yeah, so I remember when I got my first TV gig, I went back and I actually tried to count how many.
Yeah.
And it's a little bit of a skewed number because this is like total auditions for, you know, plays, musicals, TV, readings, everything all together over like 5 years. I think over that 5 year period, I went on around like 200 auditions.
Wow.
And there were bookings in there. They were for theater, you know, so I would probably do, you know, my batting average for theater was probably like, you know, 20, 30 auditions to get one part. And then for TV and film, it was a lot bigger. But now thankfully that number is actually starting to go down. And I've done three things in like the last year, but this is like the first year where that's happened. You know, it was like, okay, I did something in 2020, then in 2021, I didn't do anything at all. Then, I mean, obviously we had a, you know,
not a lot of actors did a lot of things that year.
But, you know, and then in 2022, I did one thing, and then 23, 24, I did three things. And it's kind of like, I'm a big believer in like looking back, like, and connecting the dots backwards and believing that the dots are going to keep connecting forwards. Because so often we're just like, oh my gosh, like I'm never going to get another job, you know, nothing's ever going to happen for me. And then if you look back at like stuff you've actually done in your life, you're like, oh, I've actually like got, like, regardless of what, even in your field, you know, regardless of what people do, it's like, oh, I have like a body of work of stuff that I've done. So the only way that it's not going to continue forward is if I just stop.
We are visiting today with North Dakota native John Ford Dunker, who moved out to New York a few years ago and has been cast in some theater and some TV work. And let's talk a little bit about, John, do you act differently, or how do you act differently when you are on stage versus on screen? You don't get multiple takes on stage.
Yeah, it's a good question. I think, you know, people say it, and I think it's true, this idea that like stage is really kind of the purest and most true form of acting, because there's nowhere to hide. You know, you're kind of doing the whole thing all at once. I think on stage, everything is kind of bigger on stage. You know, it was a bit of a challenge for me to go from like musical theater and stage work to TV and film, because on TV, you know, if you think a certain thought, it's going to like show up on your face. Like you don't have to sort of mime it out. Like it's just going to, the camera's going to capture everything. So you got to strip everything back. And I was told for a long time by agents and casting directors that, you know, my TV acting was too theatery, you know, it was too stagey, it was too big. So I kind of had a process of kind of trimming all of that back. But what's really interesting too is I remember when I started getting on these sets, there was something about it that was very familiar. And there was this like stop, start, you know, set up the lights, change the camera, stop. You're kind of waiting most of the day. You're only really working for, you know, almost like minutes and like an hour or so out of the whole day, because all of it has to do with like the crew and set up. And I was like, this feels familiar. And then I realized, I was like, oh, this is like a tech rehearsal for theater. Because in tech, for theater, that's the 2 days that the crew gets to put up the lights and everything else. And the actors have been rehearsing for weeks and weeks. And with tech, you're stopping, you're starting. And you don't necessarily have to be as on in between, but you kind of do. And that was something that really translated to the TV film world, is this idea of kind of, all right, it's a tech rehearsal. There's going to be a lot of sitting around, but then you also have to be kind of ready to go at a moment's notice, which if you're doing something like a scene that's just in an office with people talking, that's much easier to do than if you're doing, say, like a fight scene or, you know, something that's more emotional. You know, that's why these actors get paid so much money, is because they have to be able to do that at the drop of a hat when they've been, you know, sitting in a chair for 2 hours. It's like, okay, get up and all right, and cry and
right.
punch the guy in the face and, you know, all this stuff. So
it's like a cat that can be purring and then immediately spring to action and then go right back to purring.
Exactly.
Have you come to a point at all where you are getting sort of starstruck at all? You are starting to be cast in series that have some big names attached to them. You're in Blue Bloods with Tom Selleck and Donnie Wahlberg here.
Yeah. So I yes and no. You know, it's like I remember the first EV thing I worked on. Kevin Bacon was in the scene that I was in. And you know, I was starstruck, but I think in one way I'd get so freaked out that I'm going to make a fool of myself that I sort of just act. I just try my best to just like act normal. And then what's funny is when you do that, they just come up and talk to you. They're just like, hey, like, what's up? How you doing? Like, you know, I'm Kevin, you know, I'm Donnie, whatever. If you're like, if it's showing up that you're starstruck or that you're, you're nervous or whatever, then that's when they're going to kind of like get weird and probably not want to interact with you as much. But so it kind of started as sort of like fake it till you make it. And then I kind of realized that I don't get starstruck. Really, I think in the way that most people do, like I get starstruck by people that I think most people don't necessarily get starstruck by. Like all my favorite actors are very like obscure people that, like I worked with an actor recently, Jesse Plemons, who is nice. Like one of my favorite actors. And he's like, people know who he is, but he's also kind of a, that guy. People are like, oh, like that guy's in this and that, but he's not like a bigger name, Tom Cruise or Robert De Niro or, you know, something like that. But I was like, oh my gosh, like this guy's one of my favorite actors. And, you know, so I got starstruck by him, but, it's kind of different with different people.
Is your goal then to be more like the that guy, or are you going after some leading man stuff in your future? Do you think?
I think, I think at this point, I really just want to work consistently. And I'm very happy with kind of, you know, the industry is going to pigeonhole you to a certain extent. And I am fine with that. You know, I think the problem with kind of getting involved with acting at a younger age is you're playing all these parts in high school and college that you'll never play in the real world. So I actually played a bunch of leading men in high school and college. But that was high school and college, right? That wasn't like, they didn't have like older actors to play those parts. And whereas now you get out in the world and you're like, oh, there's literally like hundreds and thousands of people that are quote unquote, maybe better for that part. And you kind of, I mean, casting, like what you get called into audition for kind of dictates what you are, what your type is. And I was told by a mentor years ago, he's like, yeah, you're probably going to go out for a lot of cops, firefighters, you know, blue collar guys. And that's mainly what I go out for. So he knew what he was talking about. But honestly, those roles tend to be more interesting, I find, too. And, you know, maybe I'll get to a point where I'm like, oh, I really want to be playing like the lead. But typically when I watch movies, the guys that kind of come in and are kind of weird and just like have like weirder things about them, or maybe they only have a few lines, I'm always watching. I just like those guys better. And that's kind of like the parts that I'm getting cast as. So for right now, I'm very content.
We're visiting today with John Ford Dunker about what it takes to be making it as an actor. And I guess I should ask that question right there. Are you making it exclusively as an actor? Do you have, you know, a day job kind of thing?
Oh, yeah, yeah. So I have a day job. I basically, you know, for years I did the thing where, you know, you're an actor, you work in a restaurant and bartend. So I did that for a long time. And then coming out of COVID, I'd known a number of performers that had gotten corporate jobs that kind of still did performing on the side, and they made, you know, much more money doing that than waiting tables. So I thought I would give that a try, and I've actually been doing that for the past 3 years. You know, I'm an office assistant at a finance firm, and they're very supportive. You know, they know that I didn't move to New York to do that, and you know, kind of let me come and go. And they know that there's going to come a time where I'm going to need, you know, not just a couple of days off here and there, but I'm going to be like, hey, I need to go to the UK for, you know, 3 months, and that'll be it for that job, you know. But until that day comes, they've been very good to me. And, you know, I also, my fiance and I, we also are kind of working on like a side venture on the side. We work with some people kind of building out like online businesses. Like I know like a lot of actors have like side hustles and stuff like that. It's pretty much a necessary thing, especially these days. So a couple different things going income wise outside of acting, which I love, because when you don't, you put all of your eggs in one basket. I mean, imagine someone that is like, okay, and I don't think there's anything wrong with going all in on being an actor. I'm not saying that, but when you are fully dependent on that as an income stream, and also, you know, this is a whole other conversation. Once we talk about the realities of what actors actually get paid, which is nowhere near what people think that they get paid. There was a whole strike about this last summer. Then the reality kind of starts to set in of like, okay, cool. Let me kind of diversify a little bit. Let me set myself up a little better so that I'm not like, and what's interesting then is because then you're not putting so much pressure on yourself to be like, oh I've got to get this part. I have to get this part. Because then when you go in the room, it shows up in your performance. And they're like, this guy's nervous, this guy's crazy, whatever. But so once I kind of evened that out with some other things, I could go in and like be more relaxed and, you know, catch 22, started booking more, you know. So it's kind of a whole, it's all connected.
Do you want to talk about what you're making?
Money-wise? From acting?
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So the past, I think in 2022 and 2023, I think both of those years, I made between, I would say, $12,000 and $14,000 from acting. So not a lot. So it's not necessarily...
You're not getting $1 million an episode, John?
No. That's Donnie, you know. And but get this. So they were going to cancel Blue Bloods after season 13. And the only reason that it stayed on the air is because the series regulars took a pay cut. So all the way up, people are getting squeezed just so, because think about it. If let's say you cancel season 14 of Blue Bloods, that's not just the series regulars. That's like 500 people that they're like bread and butter 9 to 5 is working on that show. That's all the crew. That's all the caterers. That's all the people behind the scenes. So they all took a pay cut to sort of give those people a living. And that's happening at the absolute top of CBS, and Blue Bloods is like their number one show. So just imagine what's going on behind the scenes at all these other shows, you know. So just a little glimpse into like the whole money situation.
Yeah. How was the strike for you? And remind us a little what was going on there. It was primarily about writers, right?
Yeah, you know, so it started out as a writer's strike. And then there was an actor strike right after that at the same time. So basically the writers union and the actors union, and really there was another union right now, IATSE, which is like the stagehands union. All of those unions renegotiate their contracts. I think it's every 3 years. And so the last time that had been renegotiated was, I think, right at the beginning of 2020, which obviously a lot had changed in those 3 years. And not only, you know, in inflation and affecting wages and all of that, kind of the obvious things, but also you kind of have this the dawn of AI and the encroachment of AI on not just writers, but also actors. You know, we're talking about, you know, putting things in people's contracts that is in the fine print. They can get scanned as a digital replica and, hey, you know, we want to use John in season 15 of Blue Bloods, but actually not, because like we got a scan of him and we're just going to make like an AI version of him that we have to pay zero money. So yay for us, more for us. Lots of stuff like that, that really needed to be ironed out and sussed out and really kind of putting some safeguards in place for the future. It's not even so much what's happening right now. It's sort of what is going to be able to happen in the next 10, 15, 20 years. And I think they got a lot of the stuff they wanted, and we got a lot of stuff that we wanted with the acting contract as well.
Mm-hmm.
Not a perfect contract by any means, but I think a good step in the right direction.
What advice do you have for anyone who's right where you were pursuing your dreams?
First off, I would say go for it. You know, I lucked out. I also had parents that were very supportive. And if you don't have support around you, I would just go and find it. You know, hopefully, you know, to the young person, it's like, hopefully the parents are supportive of that. But if not, it doesn't mean that you can't do it. You just got to maybe, you know, love your parents and maybe find another community that is going to support you in that. And then, yeah, I would go for it. And I would also find someone, I would find a mentor, you know, I would find someone that has done it successfully, that's gone before you, that you can, you know, take them out to coffee, you know, take them out to dinner, ask them questions. Really, I've found that like mentorship and like sort of seeking help in that regard has cut a lot of years off the grind, because it's, you know, you want to be able to be like, hey, like, what mistakes did you make? What would you do differently? Kind of how you're asking me this, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I think that has helped me a lot. I know several colleagues of mine are working very, very successfully in TV and film. And, you know, I can sit at home on the couch and get jealous of them on social media, or I can like get advice from them and help from them. And so I kind of went that route, and I think it's helped out a lot.
John Ford Dunker, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you. Really appreciate it.
Coming after the break, Tom Ezern stops by with a Plains folk essay titled Grass Widow. What's that term mean? And Rick Guillon talks about the importance of local food nonprofits. That's after this.
I like bagels.
Have some salad.
All right, eat a pizza.
Eat some barbecue.
Apple sauce and some nice red beets.
All right, we've heard the music, and that means it's Wednesday and time for Prairie Place with Rick Guillon. Rick, welcome back to Main Street.
Good to be with you again, Craig.
It's always good to be with you, Rick. And today we're talking about food-related nonprofits. Give us an overview of what food-related nonprofits are.
Well, I think they're organizations that give back to the community in a way with the gift of food. And everyone likes to eat, and everyone needs to eat. And so they're tremendously important for providing nutrition and for the health of a community. And so I really wanted to highlight these three today because I think they do a lot of important work, especially in the eastern side of the state.
First one we want to talk about is Farm in the Dell. That's an outfit that's near Moorhead. In fact, you have some original sound that you'd like to share with our listeners.
Yeah, and that's Anna Sather with Farm in the Dell of the Red River Valley.
I'm here with Anna Sather with Farm in the Dell at a special event. Anna, tell us a little bit about what Farm in the Dell is?
So Farm in the Dell is a nonprofit. We're just north of Moorhead. We our mission is to transform disabilities into abilities. And we do that by way of providing meaningful employment and life experiences in a community farm setting to individuals with developmental disabilities. So our crew comes out every day from about mid-April through early October, and they grow an 8-acre garden. It's really wonderful because they receive a regular and steady paycheck. We teach them skills, right, like in the garden of how to grow their own produce, and then also all the soft skills of what it takes to, you know, communicate with the supervisor, how to stay positive when things get tough. And then also we make sure that they feel lifted up, respected, celebrated every single day in the way that they deserve.
So talk about a little bit about the produce that's out here. I see a large field, two large fields, three large fields. What kind of things do you grow out here?
Yep. So we have about an 8-acre garden, plus we have a small fruit orchard that we're continuing to expand, which is really exciting. We have all the traditional garden produce. So we have, you know, the carrots, the onions, the peas, the green beans, pumpkins, squash, strawberries. We're starting to expand our fruit. So we have over 100 varieties of crops, which is really exciting because every year it seems like we're testing out some new ones. But we definitely kind of get a sense from our CSA shareholders, and also this year we're going to get a sense from our market attendees kind of what their favorite things are. So we do try to kind of cater to you know, what people in the area are really wanting.
And how many folks do you employ out here?
Yep, so we have 30 garden engineers, and those individuals have, you know, Down syndrome, autism. They come with a variety of differing abilities, right, where we kind of try and meet them where they're at, and we want to be as welcoming as possible. And so if there's individuals who, you know, can't, for example, if someone's in a wheelchair, we'll find things as best we can they can do out in the garden, or, you know, we have a handful of garden boxes that they can kind of wheel themselves up to and weed and, you know, harvest things out of the box. So we try to do our best to, you know, meet them where they're at.
So folks can feel really good about coming to the market or joining the CSA. Now, the CSA, what kind of items are offered if someone wants to join?
Yep, so we offer probably over 40 different crops in the CSA. So for those of you who don't know, CSA stands for Community Supported Agriculture, and it's a unique model where customers can make a down payment in the spring, and then they get weekly produce boxes during the growing season. So it's kind of a surprise what is ready each week, but it's all dependent on what is ripe and what is ready for harvest. So early in the season, it's a lot of, you know, things like radishes and lettuce, and right now we're heavy into the cucumbers and zucchini and onions and carrots, and then in a couple weeks it's gonna, you know, we're gonna have tomatoes, potatoes, corn, squash, all the hearty fall things ready. So it's really cool to see the evolution of it throughout the growing season.
And talk a little bit about this new market that you're offering.
Yeah, so we're gonna be open on Thursdays from 4 to 6 p.m. out at the farm for the month of August, and then possibly into September a little bit depending on how the season looks. But we're gonna have a variety of things available each week, and it's just another beautiful way to involve the garden engineers in the distribution process of the produce. And you know, we're going to teach them how to use a till, how to count money, how to stock a storefront, how to engage with customers. So it's going to be a really beautiful way to include them.
And just tell people where you're located.
Yep, so our address is 7426 40th Street North. We're actually just a little bit north of the Walmart in Dilworth. We're about 15 minutes from downtown Fargo. So we're pretty close.
Sounds good. That's Anna Sather with Farm in the Dell.
So Rick, they have a huge garden north of Moorhead. Is it cool?
It is very neat, and it's acres and acres, and they have everything from flowers to corn to peppers to zucchini. They have everything, and they have 30 garden engineers with certain disabilities, varying degrees, that help them maintain this garden. And it's really a cool outfit. So the money that you pay for their CSA or community supported agriculture, your box of food you might get every week, something like that, goes to paying these folks and giving them a paycheck every month. And it's just a really neat program to see, and a lot of smiling faces there.
And there's two events left in the Table to Farm series.
Table to Farm series, you get to go out there and eat a meal, and we'll transition into Heart and Soul Community Cafe in a second here, but Heart and Soul helps them create this meal. There's special speakers. The next one on August 8th is Andrea Baumgartner from Burn Bombs. The last one in July was Molly Ye, who was on Main Street not too long ago. I interviewed her. So there's special events that it's a good meal al fresco, and you get to overlook this big garden.
Their slogan, I think, is just awesome.
Transforming disabilities into abilities, teaching folks skills. It's tremendously important.
What's the Heart and Soul Community Cafe?
Well, it's basically a mobile food truck that is around the FM area that creates meals for folks that maybe can't afford a full meal. If you can't afford it, then you pay full price. Some people pay extra just to like pay it forward so folks can get a free meal. If you can't afford a meal, they'll give you a free meal. If you can only afford part of it, it's only maybe $5. And these meals are created by chefs around town. So they're actually very, very good. A lot of the produce is donated. Some of it is from Farm in the Dell, actually. Heart and Soul Community Cafe does a lot of good around the community. You'll see their food truck at the Red River Market, but you also see it in neighborhoods where maybe some folks don't have that high of income and could maybe need some help that day.
And you can find out where they're going to be.
Yes, you can. So just check out Heart and Soul Community Cafe on Facebook.
The Great Plains Food Bank, Rick, is something that I've become familiar with since we have moved to North Dakota, and they serve the entire state and also part of Western Minnesota. They do incredible work.
Incredible. That's the big word that comes to mind, incredible. And you'll see their semis driving around, their trucks driving around. They serve food pantries. They do mobile food pantries. They serve soup kitchens, shelters. And this is in the whole state of North Dakota. There are dozens of sites. In fact, I think there's over 200 partners that they partner from Clay County, Minnesota, all the way to Medora. It's an incredible operation. I have a lot of friends that work there. They do good work, and they deserve a lot of credit for making sure that North Dakota is a healthy state and it gets people the food they need.
Unfortunately, food insecurity is not just a problem here, it's a problem everywhere.
Yes.
So we need to remember that.
Yes, we do. And that's why we're talking about these three nonprofits today. And there are obviously a lot more throughout the state of North Dakota, Western Minnesota. But I really wanted to highlight these three today because they just do a lot of good work.
Our thanks to Black Coffee and Waffle. We've had our conversation here this morning. Rick, it's nice to get out and about.
Yes, this chai is delicious, and it just kind of adds to the ambiance here.
Rick, it's always a pleasure to have you with us on Prairie Place. Rick Dion.
Thanks, Craig.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by Basin Electric Power Cooperative, headquartered in Bismarck, serving 3 million consumers in 9 states with electricity from wind, natural gas, coal, and hydro.
Main Street continues on Prairie Public. Dr. Tom Ezern stops by with another of his Plains folk essays. This essay is titled Grass Widows. He gives us meaning to a phrase you may not have heard before.
A dry rye farmer was hired to look after exhibits at the Columbian Exposition in Chicago in 1893. A central figure in the exhibits was a female form composed of grasses and grains, a picture of fertility. The farmer was attending to business when a smart-aleck Hoosier from Indiana came up and said, "I say, partner, their show is great. You must have a rich country for grains out there in Dakota, but I don't see no exhibit from your divorce courts." Pointing with his thumb over his shoulder, the attendant responded, "I don't know about that. We've got a grass widow over there." Well, the story made the rounds and was a pretty good joke in 1893. But to understand it, you need to know two things. First, you have to know that in the 1890s, on account of lenient legislation as to residency requirements, Fargo was the divorce capital of America. Second, you need to know what a grass widow is, or was considered to be at the time. I confess that for years I was conscious of the term, but thought little about what it meant. I sort of presumed it had something to do with the cattle industry. Maybe a grass widow was the widow of a stockman left to hold down the ranch on her own. Centuries ago, for the term is first known to have appeared in writing in 1528, a grass widow was a pejorative phrase referring to a woman with a child conceived otherwise than in a marital bed. Not to get too coarse about it, but the reference was to a roll in the hay. By the late 19th century, the usage had evolved to label any woman who had a husband or mate, but whose man was, perhaps unaccountably, absent. She was on her own. Also, various authorities on language, always vaguely cited, had fashioned new interpretations of the phrase. They said the correct usage, claiming French or Latin antecedents, was grace widow, connoting a woman living on the grace of the community. Etymologists today say this was a ruse, an attempt to make nice of a sordid usage. Popular idiom retained a sense of the unsavory or at least risque, often humorous. Like in the joke from the Chicago Exposition. The Emmons County Record in 1899 offered this definition. The widow's husband has been buried, but the husband of the grass widow has merely been mislaid. Two, given the fluid social situation of the frontier, not to mention the plethora of divorcees or soon-to-be divorcees in Dakota, the West was understood by the rest of the country to have more than its share of grass widows. One joke about Fargo specifically was that homeowners had been compelled to post signs reading, "Keep off the grass." If a man exhibited symptoms of hay fever, his cronies would accuse him of consorting with grass widows. The editor in Cooperstown declared in 1883 that his information about the prospects of settlement in Dakota Territory was as eagerly sought after as are grass widows at hugging socials. His counterpart in Botno in 1903 claimed his news columns were as full of sensation as the life of a grass widow. A merchant in Jamestown sold a candy bar called the Grass Widow. Beyond the humor, grass widows, even more so than bachelors, were often considered a negative or at least awkward element in prairie society. They were watched, and their doings reported in the press. I'll go on to tell you about that, because it informs us about the culture of the time and place.
Our longtime friend Tom Ezern is a distinguished professor of history at North Dakota State University. Up next, we re-air an excerpt from the Great American Folk Show about the Theodore Roosevelt Presidential Library.
Arts programming on Prairie Public is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, a state agency developing, promoting, and supporting the arts in North Dakota.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Craig Blumenschein. Folk singer and songwriter Tom Brousseau, host of the Great American Folk Show on Prairie Public, visits with Edward O'Keefe, who explores Theodore Roosevelt's legacy and the creation of his presidential library.
Edward O'Keefe, thank you so much for being on the show today.
Thank you very much for having me. I really appreciate it.
TR has a history in most of our North Dakota towns. You went to Red River High School. The mascot is Teddy Roosevelt. There was a Roosevelt Elementary School not too far from there. But in your pursuit of writing this book, The Loves of Theodore Roosevelt, your opinion of him must have changed greatly. What was your impression of Theodore Roosevelt before?
Well, I love that you brought that up. I mean, I guess it was preordained. I was a Rough Rider, so I had to at some point embrace TR in my life. I like to say that to those not from North Dakota, when you're born in North Dakota, you get your birth certificate and your choice of heroes: Lawrence Welk, Peggy Lee, Roger Maris, or Theodore Roosevelt. I chose TR. Maybe you chose Peggy Lee. That explains the Great American Folk Show. But so much is written about Theodore Roosevelt being the product of his own will. And that is true. That's true. But it's also not the whole truth. There is more to the story. When I started researching this book, I wanted to write about Theodore Roosevelt in the Badlands. I wanted to take that story of recovery and resilience, of healing, and tell it in a more emotional and emotive way. And I have to tell you, I started doing the research. It's an extraordinary story. It's certainly been a part of a lot of stories and books about TR, and I kept bumping into the women. I would find this note from Bammy to TR, giving him some very strategic advice, or I would find some incredible letter from MIDI where she's showing this vivacious personality, and then this treasure trove of material around Alice that really hadn't been the subject of a lot of exploration. I mean, most biographers write Alice off as a Victorian waif, as somebody who had no influence over TR's future. And yet in 1880, TR is writing an effusive declaration of equality between women and men. I felt like, wow, here is a person who is known for this hyper-masculine reputation, for good reason. He did incredibly daring, somewhat crazy things throughout his life. He lived a great life of strenuous adventure, and those are fabulous stories to explore. But wow, look at this emotional side where he makes these connections with these powerful women. He treats them as equals long before society or politics did. And doesn't that say something even more interesting about this incredibly complex president? I like the idea of Theodore Roosevelt as a self-made man. I think it's an inspiring story. I love him even more knowing that at points in his life, he needed help. And I wanted to write about those people who helped Theodore Roosevelt become the great person we all admire today.
Was this a position that you were striving for in life?
No, I can tell you honestly, I had no thought that I would ever be leading the Theodore Roosevelt Presidential Library Foundation. And I'm a TR historian and an admitted TED head. So it just felt like this was one of those once in a lifetime providential opportunities. It really did feel like this was one of those universe telling you, you must go in this direction moments. I was researching what became the book. I was thinking about what I wanted to do next in my career. I worked at ABC News and now this and at CNN. There I was at this kind of juncture in my life and career. And I meet somebody from my home state who says there's this amazing, ambitious project. We have no money, we have no architect, and we have no land. But other than that, I think it's going to be a sure thing. Why don't you come on board? North Dakota and North Dakotans seem primed to believe in this idea. They just needed to see a little more of a plan. I thought, I have no qualifications for this. I come from media, but one thing I do know how to do is tell a story. And so we started by telling a story. The story is Medora. Medora is this magical place where that is where history happened. You can feel it around you. It is this crosswinds of indigenous American history and Manifest Destiny, Theodore Roosevelt, the Marquis de Moore, all of these incredible, exceptional moments that collide in this Western meets Eastern town. And I thought, this is a story that America needs right now. We need to look back to understand our past, but also to inform our present and make a better future together as Americans. I mean, that's Theodore Roosevelt doesn't need a presidential library, but America needs a Theodore Roosevelt Presidential Library, because this is somebody that brings people together. It reminds us all of civic responsibility and that we are all Americans first. And I think that's what I've found so inspiring about the project and why I just couldn't resist.
Some of the milestones you've hit since the Theodore Roosevelt Presidential Library was first proposed include raising $100 million, securing the site in Medora, North Dakota, and also getting the blessing of the Roosevelt family, who are among your top supporters. What milestones lay ahead?
So some highlights of to come this summer. They're going to begin the construction of the rammed earth walls, and the roof will actually begin to appear in November of 2024. Then it's about a year of work and the interior before we can get the exhibits team inside to begin installing those immersive, interactive, almost theatrical experiences that are really going to transport you throughout Theodore Roosevelt's life. And they're going to work on those for about a year until our anticipated opening of July 4th, 2026, which is the 250th anniversary of America and the Declaration of Independence.
A very significant date. How do you think the library will add to the North Dakota experience?
I mean, I've heard people say to me quite often in state and outside of it, what Mount Rushmore is to South Dakota, the Theodore Roosevelt Presidential Library will be to North Dakota. And I say thank you. I appreciate that. That is wonderful. But I slightly correct them and say Medora will be to North Dakota what Mount Rushmore is to South Dakota. There was a reporter out in Medora in last October, and she turned to me at some point and said, Medora is a sleeping giant, and it's about to wake up. This is where history happened.
Edward O'Keefe, author of The Loves of Theodore Roosevelt, due out May 7th on Simon & Schuster, and also the CEO of the Theodore Roosevelt Presidential Library. Thank you so much for visiting with me today.
Hey, Tom, it was great to be with you. And for those that want The Loves of Theodore Roosevelt, available for pre-sale now. We've got it over at Zambros in Fargo. We've got it at Ferguson Books in Bismarck. And our good friend Doug Ellison at the Western Edge is carrying the book in Medora. So hopefully you can find it in North Dakota and wherever you like to buy books.
Ragtime piece that you're hearing right now, that's Scott Joplin, and the title of it comes from a Theodore Roosevelt speech, one that he gave in 1899 in Chicago, Illinois. The speech is called The Strenuous Life. One of the lines from that speech is, I wish to preach not the doctrine of ignoble ease, but the doctrine of the strenuous life. Anyway, when Scott Joplin heard this speech, he was really moved by it, so he decided to write the song. Entitle it The Strenuous Life. That's one of two songs composed by Scott Joplin in honor of Theodore Roosevelt. And a couple years later, Joplin wrote another piece of music, a ragtime opera. He was, again, very moved by President Roosevelt. Roosevelt invited civil rights activist Booker T. Washington to the White House. Well, he named the title of that second one, A Guest of Honor.
Find and follow your tradition Saturdays at 5 o'clock on Prairie Public. That's when the Great American Folk Show airs.
This is Dakota Datebook for August 7th. In his book about the Great Plains, Ian Fraser wrote, a nuclear missile silo is one of the quintessential Great Plains objects. To the eye, it is almost nothing, but to the imagination, it is the end of the world. During the Cold War, the Great Plains provided an ideal location for Minuteman missiles for three reasons. The shortest distance to the Soviet Union is over the North Pole. A missile launch from North Dakota could reach the Soviet Union in 30 minutes. North Dakota also provided protection by being far from coastlines, meaning more warning time if missiles were launched from submarines off either coast. Placing the missiles on the Great Plains also meant they were far from major population centers. Fewer lives would be at risk from an attack on the sites. The Cold War did not break out into open warfare, but that did not mean the relationship between the United States and the Soviet Union was friendly. By the 1950s, both countries were frantically building up military supplies. The underlying distrust and the frantic arms race caused tension and uncertainty. The arms race included nuclear weapons. One example in the United States is the Minuteman I intercontinental ballistic missile, which could be launched from underground. Subterranean missile silos soon dotted the Great Plains. On this date, in 1965, the first Minuteman missile in North Dakota was installed in a silo near Inkster. The 321st Missile Wing included launch sites that were on the alert 24 hours a day. Eventually, the state had 150 missile silos and 15 command centers. As the American-Soviet relations began to thaw in the 1980s, the missiles quietly began leaving North Dakota. Command centers were closed, and missiles were loaded onto trucks, destined for storage or redeployment. Although they were gone, the missiles left their silos behind. The State Historical Society of North Dakota acquired Command Post Oscar Zero, 4 miles north of Cooperstown, and Missile Silo November 33, 2 miles east of the town. The Ronald Reagan Minuteman Missile State Historic Site tells the story of North Dakota's role in the Cold War, preserving this important part of the state's history. Today's Dakota Datebook, written by Dr. Carol Butcher. I'm Ann Olquist.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding by Humanities North Dakota, North Dakota's largest lifelong learning community.
And that's a wrap for this edition of Main Street, and we are grateful you have spent time with us. Tomorrow on the show, we'll visit again with our go-to presidential scholar, Dr. Michael Patrick Cullinane from Dickinson State University. What's he think about Kamala Harris's vice presidential pick and the presidential race that's ahead? That's tomorrow on Main Street, and we hope you'll join us.